Republicans are you know, not trying to recruit the Mexican vote or the Chicano vote for them. And that's an example that should be brought out, how he was just thrown under the bus and forgotten about.
That's a point well taken. Yeah, mm-hmm. No, we touched upon that, but we didn't mention Alberto Gonzalez, and that's a good point. And they're very selective.
Yes, and I love the coverage. I just kind of wish that you would within the team. I know the budgets and everything, but it'd be kind of nice if you could be able to add like a Chicano perspective added to your team. Hopefully on the Democratic side, because just to get that perspective and the different. Point of view also too, but other than that, you know, anybody listening, continue supporting and donating to all the KPFA organizations, radio stations, wherever you're at. Good work, guys.
Yeah, thank you, and hopefully you'll be listening in tomorrow. We're dealing with a number of issues around immigration, so just tune in then and check it out.
All right, Caroline, just let you know, we got a word that you called it right about Barbara. She called back to
our station. Oh, I thought so. That's very wonderful. Yeah, that was the only possible thing. Going, it's a poignantly pertinent metaphor. Thank you.
Is she back on the line?
Or? No, she just called to confirm.
She just called back and to confirm. Again, the number is 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. We do have an email here from Planet People Net. Says while there are better choices than the Democrats, such as the Greens or the Peace and Freedom Party, we cannot do much worse than the Republicans. We should not allow them to take over more of our country. They've already done too much damage, and we don't need any more of this. And again, you can get your email read here by emailing us at conventions@pacifica.org.
And you're one of the best email readers that I've heard in a long time, Mitch. I mean, you enunciate every word. You give it a lot more feeling. I mean, you make an email sound good.
And a phone number.
Yes. That's the email reader, Mitch.
And the number is 1-800-958-9008.
And just to honor Cole Lott's comment and Planet People, Ned, it is an interesting statistic that Obama to win needs 80% of minority vote, again, black, Hispanic, Asian. And it's like that's what he's got to have. So it is the rise of it is crucial. I just want to just sort of put that interesting statistic. Romney's got to get 61% of the white vote. Obama needs 40% of the white vote if he gets 80% of the minority vote. There we go. We're just putting that on.
And that program was brought to you with portions on recording. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. Stay tuned now for Hour of the Wolf.
And I would also point out that the mention
This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. This morning, well, we've been on a roll lately, as I've said. Another one of the absolute utter greats in science fiction will be with us by phone, Michael Bishop. Stay tuned. Once again, good morning. I'm just going to make sure that everything is fine with the phone line. Mike, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, good. And you sound, and the sound quality is excellent. Well, thanks to Sydney Smith for setting that up for us. Before you and I get started, I just want to make announcements, and they're extremely brief. One of them is... Well, okay, yes, I know I only deal with the most important highbrow science fiction and all that, but as fanboy, I must announce that the new season of Doctor Who begins on TV this Saturday. So, there. and the other announcement involves Friday night. It's a blue moon. Enjoy it. Okay, those are my announcements. There are no readings that I'm aware of this week. The next New York Review of Science Fiction reading begins on September 11th with Richard Bowes and Carlos Hernandez. And more information on that on my website at ourwolf.com or on Facebook. Just search out... New York Review of Science Fiction Read, or better yet, NYRSF, N-Y-R-S-F, Readings. And there you'll see my reading series. So, enough of that prattle. I have to say, Michael, I didn't prepare a proper introduction for you. It's a fault of mine, but there are a few people who I have on the air, and you are certainly... one of them, that there is just so much to say and so many wonderful hours and moments that you have given me and us in your writing that I hardly know where to begin. I guess we would describe you as a science fiction and fantasy author of prose. You're also a poet and a teacher. The first thing that I remember reading was the novel A Funeral for the Eyes of Fire.
Well, that was the first one I wrote.
Well then, okay, so I was in sync at that point.
Absolutely.
And then a lot of short stories I remember reading Under Heaven's Bridge. I remember totally enjoying, I loved to a manic degree, Philip K. Dick is Dead, Alas.
That was a lot of fun to write.
Oh, yeah. A lot of fun to read. It was the best Philip K. Dick novel he never wrote.
I like that description as well. And the novel that you mentioned, Under Heaven's Bridge, is one that I wrote with Ian Watson.
Right.
And we called it at the time the first transatlantic science fiction collaboration. I don't know whether that would hold today. I think there have been other such collaborations since, I believe. But I think that was true at the time that we wrote it.
It probably was, and you did it gasp by mail.
Absolutely.
Paper mail.
We had no access to the Internet in those days, and we exchanged portions of the story back and forth, and that was how we did it, through the mails.
Yeah. It's a collaborations are always a fascinating thing, and you've done any number of them, right?
I haven't done that many, to tell you the truth. I've collaborated on short fiction with Gerald W. Page, who lives in Atlanta and who was one of the first people I met in the science fiction world. I've done another with a writer that, my goodness, I'm having a hard time even recalling his name at this point. He was an American Indian.
Really?
Craig. This is terrible. He's gone out of my head. It's been a long, long time since we did the collaboration together.
And
he has gone out of the field since then.
You have collaborated, am I incorrect, with Paul DiFilippo?
Oh, well, you know, yes. We did a story together that appeared in Inner Zone. And
mm-hmm.
We have collaborated, I guess I should bring that up, but we've collaborated on two mystery novels. So I wasn't even thinking of those in the context of science fiction.
Yeah, but it's your writing still.
Absolutely.
Paul
has been a good friend for a long time.
His name came up 2 weeks ago when my guest was Harlan Ellison. And I asked Ellison, you know, who are you reading today? And he said, well, there's nobody who's good. The best writer today is Paul DiFilippo.
Well, I understand where he's coming from when he says that, because Paul can do just about anything. And I know that Harlan is a big fan of Paul's, and understandably so.
Yeah, but for him, Harlan...
To say that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
and he can wax or wane. Harlan, he's just as happy to tear somebody down. And I've seen him do it recently, too, or at least about 5 years ago, at a ReaderCon, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, I enjoy it when he finds it within himself to praise somebody, and especially when he praises somebody like Paul.
Yeah, and he did that. Another novel of yours that was a favorite of mine was Count Geiger's Blues.
Mm-hmm.
And I am only now encountering... which is actually part of what brought us together, a novel which may become my favorite of yours, Brittle Innings.
It's perhaps my favorite among everything that I've ever written. I think writers do occasionally rank in their own consciousness, at least, their works and where they stand. And I think Brittle Innings is just about the best thing I've ever done. And when I start thinking... You know, down the line a little bit, I think about Ancient of Days, which is a novel that I think a great deal of still. And it's interesting to me that you mentioned Count Geiger's Blues, because just recently I have been working on that book again. Orion Publishing in England has gone to contract with me on 16 of my books.
Ooh.
Probably 10 novels and 6 story collections, in order to present them as e-books in this coming year. And before that happened, I wanted to make sure that the books were as good as I could make them. So in the case of Count Geiger's Blues and Ancient of Days and A Funeral for the Eyes of Fire, I have gone back through these books and line edited them, and I hope to present them with brand new introductions by colleagues in the field, and the person who has written the introduction to Who Made Stevie Cry is a colleague of mine by the name of Jack Slay, Jr., who's been published in Tailbones, but who also has published a critical study of the British novelist Ian McEwan.
Uh-huh.
I think that the British will appreciate the fact that a person who is writing an introduction to my book is somebody who knows contemporary English literature well enough to write about Ian McEwan.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I'm just looking, by the way, I see Liz Hand, Elizabeth Hand, I should say, excuse me. But when she's on the show, we call her Liz. Wrote the introduction for Brittle Innings.
Well, she originally wrote a review that I think appeared in a Detroit newspaper, and she had there was a little excerpt on the previous edition of the book, which was out from Bantam in the 90s, and the excerpt was simply "All Summer in a Day." That was how she characterized the book, and of course, that was a reference to the Ray Bradbury story, but she was talking about the fact that the action in the book takes place over the course of one summer in 1943 during World War II. But when I read that, I thought, that's great, that's wonderful, all summer in a day. And when it came time for this new edition to come out, and it was...
And we should mention that this new edition is just out from Fairwood Press, which
right.
is a small...
I was going to mention Patrick Swenson and his decision to ask me if there were any way that he could do the book as a reprint and to bring it back into print. And I said, are you kidding? Absolutely. I'd love nothing better. But I could not help but think of Liz Hand as a person to introduce the book, and she was good enough to do that.
Yeah, she's come to think of it, isn't she guest of honor at World Fantasy this year?
You know, I don't know, but she should be if she isn't.
I believe she is. I'm not going to WorldCon mm-hmm. this year because if I were, I wouldn't be here tonight.
Right.
Just as I emailed Patrick Swenson earlier tonight, and he said, oh, alas, I can't listen to the show. I'm off to WorldCon. You know, so many people are. Which
he told me he didn't know whether he could stay up until 10:30, which is what time it would be there on the Pacific Coast, in order to listen to the program because of that trip.
Yeah, but the show is available for on demand for the following 2 weeks at easiest way, actually, is people go to my website at ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, or people can go to archive.wbai.org. But I will send you and Patrick an MP3 of the show.
Well, that's wonderful. My wife was saying, you know, I don't know whether I can stay up, and I think she's in bed at this particular moment, sleeping, and she was saying, I'm going to try to stay. I said, you don't have to, because you'll be able to listen to it in another context.
Yeah, we should tell people that we're talking to you in Georgia, is that correct?
That's right. I'm sitting here at the kitchen counter in Pine Mountain, Georgia, and it's very quiet here, I will tell you that.
What a wonderful name, Pine Mountain, Georgia. I mean, I'm from Brooklyn. I grew up in the shadows of Shea Stadium. Now I'm in Brooklyn, in a neighborhood that was home to many of the Dodgers. And I'm very, very urban.
Well, when you told me that you had grown up there earlier today when we talked before the program, I had to tell you that my favorite baseball team growing up was the Brooklyn Dodgers because I grew up in Kansas and we had no baseball team immediately in the vicinity, of course. Most people pulled for the St. Louis Cardinals, but I chose the Dodgers and I loved them.
There was
so
something
I was, delighted to hear that.
There was something magic about the Brooklyn Dodgers and
Ebbets Field. Yeah,
yeah. My partner's father, you know, he was, you know, he had his Dodger blues. He had the hat. He had the whole thing. I come from the next generation. I grew up in Queens, in the shadow of Shea Stadium, which is the closest thing that you had to a successor of the Dodgers. And, of course, they were led at some point by Gil Hodges, started with Casey Stengel, but went on to Gil Hodges. So there was that connection. But about 20 years ago, when I moved to Brooklyn, I live on this tiny little terrace, and one of the houses was Pee Wee Reese's house. And then I've discovered...
There was a hero of mine, too, because I always identified with him, not in the sense that I could in any way play baseball as he did, but I figured, well, I was small, and if he made it, so maybe somebody else small could as well.
Yeah, although I think he was taller than me. I'm 5'5", and I think he was 5'6", and for baseball, that's, you know, short.
It is, and I got to be a little taller. I mean, I'm about 5'9" now, but I was a very small kid.
Mm-hmm. And, I was a shrimp as a kid. I always was. And they would try me at shortstop. And I was quick, but I ended up playing catcher more than anything else. Don't know why. Just ended up that way.
That's a hard position.
Yeah, yeah. And I think people threw hard at me. It was softball anyway. Ah, but I did play the WBAI softball team. I did play, and that I actually got to I received a beanball from Jim Boughton.
Goodness.
The former Yankee. Because
you're still with us.
I'm still with us, yeah. Well, it was softball, and this was... when WBAI actually had its own team, and Jim Boughton was a sportscaster for ABC News.
Well, you may say it's softball, but I don't think, unless people have played the sport, they realize how hard a softball can be, especially when it hits you coming at some speed.
Yeah, but and that was one of his fastballs, because you can't do a knuckleball with a softball.
Right.
So yeah, and he hit me. He hit me, and I don't think it was on purpose. I think it was me. But one way or the other, I can claim to have gotten hit by Jim Boughton in a game. So,
well, I'm not sure that that's something I would envy.
Yeah, well.
But it is distinctive, I'll say that.
Exactly, exactly. We were sharing baseball stories earlier, and we haven't even started talking about your short fiction, but right now we're talking a little bit about brittle innings. And I was talking earlier with you, I have this utter fascination and love for speculative fiction, however you want to define that. And I use the broadest possible term, and if it turns out I'm wrong and something is, quote, mainstream, I don't care. It's a good book. But there's something about the baseball novel.
Well, it's I can't guess you can't say that it's exclusively American when you have teams in Japan playing baseball, but it's certainly a part of Americana in a way that many other sports don't seem to be. Although I understand that the most favored sport nowadays is professional football, I still have this tremendous fondness for baseball, because I do think it reflects a lot of American culture and society.
It really does, and it is, as you were saying earlier, it is literally a timeless game. It is over when something is achieved,
mm-hmm.
rather than...
When the clock runs out.
Then the clock runs out. You know, there may be innings, they brittle or not.
Right.
But it's not a timed game. I attended at least one game that ran 6 or 7 hours, not counting the rain.
Delay, yeah.
Yeah, there was a rain delay in that game. It just went on and on and on, and let out about 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. Between the rain delay and the length of the game and all that. And
I've experienced that myself at Turner Field in Atlanta.
Uh-huh. And the score constantly being tied and all of that. It might have even been the Braves.
Mm-hmm.
Mets Braves at that point. But... But there's something about the writing. I mean, the short stories, I don't know about old novels. Short stories certainly go back to the 20s,
mm-hmm.
with writers like Damon Runyon and Ring Lardner. who wrote Alibi Ike, and Bennett Cerf was writing baseball fiction. There were all these people, and then all of a sudden, and a lot of those were fantastic. I mean, the Bennett Cerf story was about a two-headed giant playing for, well, guess who, the New York Giants. And it was just filled with a lot of silliness, like, you know, he drove the catchers nuts because he would both shake off the signal and accept it at the same time.
Interesting.
Yes.
Now, that one I don't know, but I do recall that when I was probably 11 or 12 years old, I got into my stepdad's collection of old science fiction magazines, and I can't even recall which one this was, but there was one story, and I cannot remember the author's name either, but it was about a young man who could do with the ball just about anything that he wanted to, the ball and the bat, and when he went up to bat, he could almost automatically hit a home run. And that seemed to be just about his only talent, but of course teams wanted him because he had that ability. And it turned out, I think, in the end that he was an alien. But I wish I could recall the story now. But I remember that that was one of the pieces that got me interested in science fiction. That and my stepdad's collection of old science fiction magazines.
Yeah.
Were fascinating for their covers.
And, yeah, so these connections are old. And then you started getting into the great American novel, as it were. And that's, well, I guess W.P. Kinsella, being Canadian, can still be considered American, right?
I would think so. North American?
Yeah, North American. But
and they do play baseball in Canada.
Now, yeah. I think when he started at least being a fan, I don't think they did.
You don't think they played sandlot ball there?
Oh, I beg pardon. No pro ball.
Right.
No major league baseball.
Right.
Not before Montreal and Toronto.
And we were talking earlier about the Iowa Baseball Confederacy, the novel about the game that goes on virtually forever, it seems.
A wonderful, bizarre Kinsella novel. Mm-hmm. But his great novel, of course, is Shoeless Joe, mm-hmm. which was amazingly unfilmable. When you think about, you know, here's a guy who kidnaps J.D. Salinger, so that they can be
Terrence Mann, as they called him in the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
But in the book, it's J.D. Salinger.
Yes.
And they're talking about Catcher in the Rye and Salinger's alleged love for baseball. I mean, it's really an unfilmable novel. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow the movie Field of Dreams turned out rather well and I think actually captured the essence of Kinsella's writing.
And it's a film that I admire, actually. And I'm not that big a Kevin Costner fan, but I think that's perhaps his best movie.
I would go along with that, and I actually do like Costner. I'll tie that with Dancing with the Wolves.
Right.
Those are my two favorite Costner films. Mm-hmm. But it's a heck of an achievement. And then, of course, there is The Natural by Bernard Malamud.
Right.
Which is also turned into a movie, but it has a Hollywood ending, and Malamud had a Malamud ending.
Again, I have to agree with you. I saw the movie a long time ago, and as I admitted to you, to my chagrin, earlier today, I have never read Malamud's The Natural, and I don't know why, because I do like baseball novels, and I do like Bernard Malamud, especially his short fiction.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of his short fiction, and the same there is true of Kinsella. Some of his short stories, especially his baseball stories,
mm-hmm.
He has more than one collection. The Thrill of the Grass, there's a title,
yeah.
Comes to mind, and he has a short story about the Seattle Albatross is the mascot of the team, and he's an alien. But nobody realizes it.
Mm-hmm.
This is at the time when all the Henson characters, and you had the San Diego Chicken and this and that, and Seattle gets a mascot, but he's an alien. And it's a hilarious story. And right. Kinsella does these things so wonderfully.
Have you ever read any of the short fiction of Rick Wilbur?
Oh, now there's a familiar name.
He wrote a book called Where Garagiola Waits, and Rick's father played baseball in the major leagues. I believe his name was Del Wilbur, and he was a catcher for the St. Louis Cardinals during the 50s.
Wait a minute. Yeah, you know what? I haven't yet read him, but unless I'm mistaken, he did a presentation at a ReaderCon about 6 or 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible?
Oh, yeah, entirely.
Okay, and, so that's where I know the name from.
But Rick is a good writer, and he writes an interesting baseball story, and he has certainly some firsthand experience with the game because of growing up as the son of a major leaguer and being a good athlete himself as well.
Yeah.
In fact, he once came to Pine Mountain and whipped me pretty good in the driveway playing basketball. So, but he's bigger than I am, of course.
Now, let us, you know, we're talking about brittle innings, and we are alluding to the fact that this is a baseball novel, and people can guess that this is also a speculative fiction novel. I don't want to call it science fiction or fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
What can we tell people about it? Wikipedia gets actually rather precise, but I wouldn't know if you would agree with those, with the précis that they give.
Well, I think it's probably accurate. I believe, as a matter of fact, that much of the entry, if you're looking at the Michael Bishop entry in Wikipedia, may have been written by Michael Hutchins, who edited the short story collection that we are also going to talk about a little bit, The Door Gunner, which is called The Door Gunner and Other Perilous Flights of Fancy, a Michael Bishop retrospective, but on the,
just out from Subterranean Books.
Right, Subterranean Press, and it's edited by Michael Hutchins. And I think Michael wrote the Wikipedia piece, at least the original one. I don't know whether it's been changed or not. But it's probably, you know, pretty accurate when it describes the book.
As
I sometimes try not to go into too much detail about exactly what happens in it, because there is a kind of reveal in the book that some people like to find for themselves.
That's one of the reasons I'm being coy,
right,
about describing it. But
one thing I would like to say about it is that when I wrote it, it occurred to me because I was thinking of a particular character who crops up in English literature,
mm-hmm.
and I was thinking about how to work that character into a story. And one of the things that happened during World War II, of course, is that many of the able-bodied major league ball players enlisted or were called up. And as a consequence of that, many of the ball players who were left to play the sport here in the homeland, so to speak, were men who were 4F or who were extremely young or extremely old or who had a disability of some kind.
One-armed, yeah. Pete Gray.
As a matter of fact, there was one ball player, Pete Gray, who had one arm, and he played center field or right field for the St. Louis Browns, and he became a very popular player, at least with the fans, because he would catch the ball with one hand, transfer it out of the glove into his hand and throw the ball. People looked at him as being a kind of a phenomenon just because he could do these things and bat with one arm. Of course, he did not play very long after the war because the able-bodied players came back and he was gone.
Yeah, but I do have to say, as far as the Browns were one of my favorite teams, reading about them in history for one reason, they had the best owner of all time, Bill Veeck.
And if anybody famous for bringing a midget to the plate,
Eddie Goodell.
Yes.
famous for having Frog Day when he didn't want a game played and he couldn't get it called on account of rain, and he tried to water down the bases, but they were onto him on that trick. So one day he simply had anybody who came into the stadium was given a free frog. Nothing to put it in. You were just handed a frog, and so the game was called on account of frogs. They were all over the field. Horrible things were happening involving cleats and frogs. And
yes, I can imagine.
I wish I had heard for years that they were going to turn his biography into a movie starring Bill Murray would seem appropriate, but nothing has actually materialized.
That's too bad.
But Bill Veeck, I met him. He was quite a character. For a very short time, I did a sports show, or a baseball show, I should say. Not a sports show, baseball show here on BAI. And I got to interview Bill Veeck for that. Him and Bill Lee, those were my two big interviews.
Well, Veeck was definitely an imaginative promoter and showman, and as you can tell from the things that you just said.
But what interests me about Brittle Innings is you mentioned bringing this character in, and to be coy again, but it's sort of worth noting that many people would point out that this character is a significant character from what most people would call the first modern science fiction novel.
Right, and if anybody has read Brian Aldiss, they may already know what we're talking about.
Well, that's where I'm stealing. Yeah, well, it is Aldiss who gave me the awareness of what the first book was in modern science fiction.
Sure.
So people can extrapolate from there. But then there's also Somerset Maugham, isn't there?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, that was an influence of mine as well. One of the first major novels, or at least I considered it major at the time, that I ever read was Maugham's Of Human Bondage. And I think that there is some of what I do in Brittle Innings is influenced by the structure of that book. I read that when I was in high school, and I was extremely proud of myself because it was in a modern library edition, and it ran about 800 pages, and 800 pages seemed an unfathomable number of pages for me to read at that particular time. So I was proud of myself for having read it. It's an influence on the book as well, in an odd way.
Yeah, and it's... I don't know really what can be said other than, A, if people love the science fiction, fantasy, B, if people like great baseball novels. And here's an interesting thing. I know people who love great baseball novels who don't care for baseball.
Right. No, I have an extremely good friend and collaborator by the name of Stephen Utley, and he's not a sports nut in any way, shape, or form. And he said that even though he didn't like baseball, he read this novel and liked it simply for the story and got caught up in it, even though he's not somebody who would go out to a ball game just as an afternoon's entertainment.
Exactly. And that was the point I was going to make, is that you don't have to be either a science fiction fan nor a baseball fan to appreciate Brittle Innings. It's a great novel.
Well, again,
I haven't finished it. I didn't read it when it came out.
I admit that I derive a great deal of satisfaction from hearing people, writers that I admire, comment upon it in that way. Who would not? I know when Patrick Swinson was putting the book together, he asked me if I could find some quotations from newspaper reviews or if there were people who had ever said anything about the book. And, of course, Elizabeth Hand, in her introduction, calls it a great American novel, not a great American science fiction novel, not a great American sports novel. but a great American novel. And, of course, how can any writer not feel good to receive that kind of praise for a book?
I'm just looking through, and I noted that James Morrow, in his blurb in the beginning of the book, cites two of three books. Another book I would have mentioned, one of my favorites, Bang the Drum Slowly.
Right.
And he cites Shoeless Joe, Bang the Drum Slowly, and The Natural.
Uh-huh.
And
well, these are wonderful books to have brittle innings compared to and with, it's just a delightful thing to see the book back in print again in this really lovely edition that Patrick Swenson and Fairwood Press have done. I might mention that
the cover
Patrick's brother, Paul Swenson, designed the cover and did the illustration on the cover, which is a very dynamic cover. I liked the original cover on the Bantam edition, but it's simply the bus that the players ride in before an old Victorian house in a small town.
Uh-huh.
The cover on this novel is a ball player swinging a bat, which breaks as he hits the ball. And I think in many respects it illustrates the title of the book. As a matter of fact, I had somebody write me the other day and said, where did the expression brittle innings come from? I know it must have been a part of baseball lingo for at least 100 years. And I had to laugh, but I was also pleased because brittle innings was something that I invented for this particular book, hoping that it would eventually insinuate itself into the game to the extent that people might use it as a term.
You coined it, yeah. And with any luck, I'll tell you one thing, that cover and perhaps the phrase really belongs in Cooperstown.
And perhaps what? I'm sorry, I missed you.
The cover and the phrase, brittle innings.
Right.
I mean, the
right.
Painting itself, but why not with the why not with the title? Why not the cover as published by Fairwood?
Right.
Belongs in Cooperstown. It really does.
Well, I would agree with you there, and I would love to see that happen. I might mention that after the book appeared, somebody at Cooperstown sent me a membership card that said, because your novel is going to be displayed here, I think the original Bantam edition was displayed, sent to Cooperstown, and they put it on display there, but they sent me a lifetime membership, a card, so that if I ever get up there, I can go in and be a guest and tour the place. The only problem is I've long since misplaced that card.
I'm sure they can find it. And going up there, by the way, I find that area is worthwhile visiting, if only for Lake Glimmerglass.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, last of the Mohicans, all this is where it's Cooper. It's Fenimore and Cooper.
That's great.
It's their town, and it's beautiful. There's a good opera up there.
Uh-huh.
And really just a wonderful place, a lot of caves to explore.
Well, as I was saying, this person who wrote me asking where the term came from, I said, well, you'll have to go to the novel to find that. But I've got a passage here. It's about a character by the name of Darius Satterfield, who's a black man who is kind of the assistant manager to the minor league baseball club in Georgia called the Highbridge Hellbenders. But he's also, although this is a reveal that I think is quite small in comparison to some of the others, he's also the bastard son of the manager of the team, Jordan McKissick, a white man. And he leaves the team about three-quarters of the way along through the course of the book, but returns to get some of his belongings in a secret way and to attend a funeral of another player in secret. And he tells one of the narrator, as a matter of fact, is this something that I should bring up or mention?
Sure.
Let me just say that the narrator of the book, Danny Bowles, who's a young shortstop who has been stricken mute by something that happens to him early in the book, is able to speak, but he speaks with a stammer. And he and the other character that we have been talking about from another book asks Darius, when he sees him, "What impels you to venture forth from the Kissick house now?" That's the boarding house where they live. And Darius says, "Well, better late than no time." "That's a good question, Mr. Hendry. I think it's because my life's done crept into its briefless part, like unto them innings when the whole thing could go either way, depending on just when the crucial bone crack happened and to who. I almost waited past the snapping point. Maybe I did, but if I beat it now, maybe I'll get past my brittle innings and play on through a stretch that'll heal me, that won't just shake me down to splinters and shards." And he talks about that a little bit more, but that's where the phrase itself actually enters the book, and that's how it became the title of the book. But the whole situation is probably not very clear, explaining it in the way that I have. I do think it becomes clear in the context of the novel itself.
Well, then, I mean, we're you know, we're not being coy. People should read it.
Well, thanks.
It's really, it's, you have such a body of work. And I'm on the one hand embarrassed to say I haven't read it all, and I'm reading this for the first time. I missed it in 95. But at the same time, it speaks for this huge body that there's still so much for me to discover.
Well, you know, it's not unusual that you should not have encountered everything. A lot of my work is out of print. And I'm grateful for the fact that Orion Publishing in England has, you know, gone to contract with me to put some of the work back into print.
Yeah. The wonderful thing about ebooks is, I think there is, I say this all the time on the air and I'll repeat it, there's no reason for books to be out of print ever again.
All right, yeah. And an ebook gives you the promise, if not the outright guarantee, of literary immortality. Not necessarily as a deathless classic, but certainly as something that's potentially accessible and recallable.
Exactly.
A work that's worthy of electronic preservation and maybe susceptible then to rereading. And, of course, how could a writer not like something like that?
Now, we are actually already halfway through the show.
Sure.
And you're going to do two readings for us.
Okay.
And I thought perhaps it might be fun to start with, well, would you, what would you, I mean, after this, we're going to talk about the collection, the retrospective, edited by Michael Hutchins, but you also have a poem, and
right,
you're well known as a poet.
A few years ago, I was writing poetry on a more regular basis than I am now, and some of it, of course, ended up being speculative. And I have one collection of poetry that is out of print now, as as many things are, called Timepieces. But one of the poems in this book was called For the Lady of a Physicist, and it won the Risling Award, which is given by the Science Fiction Poetry Association for the best long poem of the year. Now, when I say long poem, people become a little bit disturbed and think that, oh, my goodness, it's going to be Paradise Lost. But actually, they meant any poem that was over about 30 lines. And so I have a poem called For the Lady of a Physicist that I wouldn't mind reading. And should I go ahead and do that?
I would love that.
Okay. First of all, it's preceded by an epic graph from Stephen Hawking, and he talks about Bekenstein's hypothesis that black holes have a finite entropy requires for its consistency that black holes should radiate thermally. And it goes on in that vein for a while, and it concludes, indeed, it is possible that the black hole could emit a television set or the works of Proust in 10 leather-bound volumes. And that's by Stephen Hawking, and it appeared in a Scientific American article. And I was reading Scientific American fairly closely at the time. And anyway, I decided to write a poem as if from the point of view of a speaking black hole or a physicist who is equating himself with a black hole. And it's it's a homage in some respects to Andrew Marvel's To His Coy Mistress. And I will go ahead and read it at this point. If I with her could only join in rapturous dance, loin to loin, deep space itself would soon discern galactic rhythm in our burn. Our bodies stars, our debts all void, then would we waltz, and thus employed, inflate with megacosmic thrust through night and death and sifting dust. Godlike lovers, we would hang beyond the cosmos, whose big bang all the mad millennia past was but a pop gun to our slow blast. And as we reeled with raw elan, pulsing plasma and vast pavan, we would shame the Pleiades, relume the Magellanic seas, deliver all our Milky Way ionic flux, too fierce to stay in supernova, and so rehearse our own expanding universe. But my small body is no star, albeit something similar, a blind pool vacuuming into it all the lambency it's not fit to redirect and render rife. The woman I would take to wife sees only blackness in my eyes, rapacious Evan, hungry skies, an ogape gravid with desire to aggrandize itself in fire, and so her light sweeps down the hole that is the maelstrom of my soul. Therefore, I have become for her a dark entropic murderer whose chiefest virtue is his pull. Then, while my strength is at its full, let me draw her to my embrace, collapse her will, and show my face. With her, my Beatrician guide, we'd tunnel with the thermal tide into the arms of Betelgeuse, with quasar sets and Marcel Proust emergent with us, glory-bound, detritus of God's lost and found. Thus, though we cannot create light from love, yet we will vanquish night.
That's wonderful.
Well, thanks. It took me a long time to write that particular poem, but I had a marvelous model in the poem by Andrew Marvel, and a poem that I've always admired. And if people do not know To His Coy Mistress, they should go out and find it.
Yeah, I think I'll have to. Let me reintroduce the program, by the way, and say that this is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City and over WBAI.org. And my name is Jim Freund. With me, Michael Bishop, one of the great, great writers of science fiction, and we are, and fantasy, and others. And we are discussing his the reprinting of one of his great novels, Brittle Innings, from Fairwood. And by the way, I got an email. Patrick Swenson is listening. So,
oh, well, great.
So,
wonderful.
So hi, Patrick. And there's a funny story there that actually involves Laura Ann Gilman, who's a New Yorker, was not going to ReaderCon for one of the few times and handed me this box. I handed a friend of mine a box of books and said, bring this to Patrick. Not Patrick who, you know, Nielsen Hayden or whatever. And finally, I figured out that it was Patrick Swenson in the Huckster Room at ReaderCon. And I delivered him this carton of books from her. And that's when my eyes lighted upon this. And Patrick and I spoke for a while. And that's how this show came into being.
It is. He said that he had talked with you. And I think you're talking about a box of Brittle Innings, right?
I never looked what it was that I was delivering.
Well, maybe I'm wrong, but
I saw
that he did have seven copies of Brittle Innings with him.
Yeah, well, he did.
At ReaderCon.
Yeah, no, he had it there on the table. And
that
was, I was just delivering something for another writer, but I saw Brittle Innings and remarked upon it. And actually, I have to say, on several other books that Fairwood is putting out, because it's an impressive list that he's got of titles.
And I'm glad to join it. I really am. You know, these are print-on-demand titles, and people can get the book, I believe, by going to fairwoodpress.com. And that's how to go about I guess, obtaining a copy.
And it's also the best way to support independent press.
True.
And people, you know, they're going, why is he mentioning the publisher all the time? And it's, you know, if it were Random House, I wouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's an independent press, I used to say small press, but Jacob Weisman beat me out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, I got it. It's independent press. So they really...
I say thank God for the independent press.
Absolutely.
I certainly don't look down my nose upon the mainstream publishers, but I will say that it seems to me that the independent press has, in many respects, preserved books that would not necessarily get a reading or a hearing at some of the bigger presses, because so much is dependent upon the bottom line nowadays.
Yeah, and I think that they are the hope in print of the future.
Right.
I really think that's true. While everybody is fighting over, the endless fights over Google Books and Amazon and the Big Six and Apple and all of this, it's turning into a technology fight. And in the meantime, people are writing books, and people are going to ReaderCon, and they are buying books. And so, okay, this may not be all of mainstream America, although I have to say, when I went to ReaderCon this year for the first time, I went to a bookstore called the New England Mobile Book Fair, not that far away in Newton Highlands, Massachusetts. And it's like this three-city block bookstore, which even a New Yorker would be impressed by.
I'm going to say hard to visualize.
It is hard to visualize, but it's well worth going to. But it's like a series of warehouses stuck together, and I don't know what they don't have.
And even
more amazingly, they have people there that know what they've got.
Yes, that does sound.
And, you know, I mean, just know what they've got. You ask somebody, and they may have to ask another person, but you're never more than two people away from an answer.
From finding the book. Huh?
From finding the book, and some are low price, and some are remaindered, and some are full price, but they've got them. As books are not dead, and they're not going to be.
I hope not, because I'm sitting here as I'm talking to you just thumbing through the edition, and not because it's my book so much. I guess I wouldn't be doing this if it weren't my book. But on the other hand, I'm looking at it because it's just a beautiful, beautiful artifact in itself. And this is something that Patrick works at, making the books attractive.
Yeah.
And something that invites you to read it. And I'm extremely happy with this copy of Brittle Innings.
Yeah, and as well you should be. Now, we should talk, as I was introducing you, I mentioned any number of your novels, but anybody who's ever listened to me talk on the air knows that I am... My favorite form is the short form. I love great novels, but there's something about short stories.
Well, I'll have to say that if it were not for short fiction, I probably would have never become a writer, because I never felt that I had the stamina to go the length that a novel requires. And I wrote short fiction to begin with, and almost exclusively, and only wrote a novel the first time I wrote a novel, because Betty Ballantyne told me you have to write a novel if you want to have a career as a science fiction writer.
Yeah.
And I think she was correct, because the only people I could think of who had made a career writing short fiction were probably Ray Bradbury and Harlan Ellison. And you have to write short fiction, I think, to learn how to write. Some people are natural-born novelists, but I wasn't one of those people, unfortunately. But short fiction seems to me to embody what most of us, when we read science fiction and fantasy, are looking at, unless we get caught up first with an epic like The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and even then, the appendices are like short stories. There are tales within that. And Tolkien wrote a lot of really good short stories.
Yeah.
So there's that. But when I think of the science fiction and or fantasy short story, I'm always reminded of James Gunn wrote an essay, and I wish I could find this. I read it on the air many, many years ago. You know, a couple of decades ago. I've been doing this so long. And he wrote about the craft of the short story and how the short story is like a polished gem. That in a novel, there's world building, yes, and you can move around and there can be sub-stories and... it's amazing, for example, what Susanna Clarke did with Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, and or Neil Gaiman with American Gods, in which there's practically short stories within the novel. Mm-hmm. But the short story itself is a polished gem. You cannot take out a word, and you shouldn't add a sentence once it really has been finished. You might tweak it a little, but it is this wonderful little polished work. I've always loved that word, polished, when it comes to short stories. Mm-hmm. And you have so many great short stories. And again, I was talking about the early ones, and I'm looking... add a bibliography right now, and I'm remembering, oh my God, Death and Designation among the Asadi, which I was reading you, I guess, about the same time that I was reading one of my other favorite male writers, James Tiptree Jr. And everybody, those who know can laugh, because Tiptree's real name was Alice B. Sheldon.
It's interesting that you mention her and Death and Designation among the Asadi virtually in the same breath, because I obtained my first agent, Virginia Kidd, the late Virginia Kidd, as a consequence of having written and published that story. And one of the first comments about the story came from Alice Sheldon, James Tiptree Jr. She said she was blown away by that story, and, you know, to a young writer, that was a wonderful thing to have a writer whom he or she admired say about your work. And as a matter of fact, Death and Designation among the Asadi became the opening section of really perhaps my first successful novel, Transfigurations.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and I would not have had the career that I've had I not written that story and attracted some attention with it.
But the thing is, it holds up today.
Well, it was one of those stories that I wrote almost as if I were in a fever pitch trance of some sort. I can recall writing it in Athens, Georgia, when my wife and I were living in a small rented house there. And when I got to the section in that story where I was writing about a creature that I called the Huri, which was a bat-like creature that appeared in the piece, a bat appeared in our house on the wall, scrabbling on the wall above the place where I was writing the story itself, almost as if I had summoned it. I will never forget that, and I will never forget that I wrote this story in a white-hot pitch that I don't think I have ever equaled again in my entire writing career.
Wow, so you had a bat for a muse.
Yeah, I don't know. I know that my wife and I both tried really hard to get it out of the house, because I think we were having company come later, and we did not want to be hosting guest with a bat flying around inside this high-ceilinged house in Athens, Georgia.
Yeah. But, you know, speaking of short stories, there's another book.
Mm-hmm.
that we want to mention that is just recently out that you mentioned earlier, the one from Subterranean Press.
Right. It came out in February. It was supposed to come out a little earlier, but Subterranean Press has a really heavy publishing schedule and a lot of work coming out, and they do try to do their best with each book, so it did not come out until February. So I've got two books out this year. The Door Gunner and Other Perilous Flights of Fancy and Brittle Innings, and I'm very, very pleased with the Subterranean Press edition of these short stories.
Yeah, again, this is like almost a crafted book. It's so well put together. And it's, I would say this is not, some might say edited by Michael H. Hutchins, as it says on the cover. I would almost say curated.
Well, Michael is a friend, but he is a person who, came to me early on and, expressed interest in creating a website for my work, which I would not have had if he had not done that. And he knew my work forward and backwards. He had been following it. And when it came time to put together a retrospective collection, I had to go to Michael and ask him what he thought belonged in it. And we made lists, each of us. And it was interesting to see how closely they corresponded in most of their particulars, but how they also diverged in some places. So I think the collection owes a tremendous amount to Michael for his, as you put it, curating it, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a fair assessment, especially because it's listed as retrospective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not to say that it's so much a best of, which might be a little bit different, and it's not the complete Michael Bishop, but it is very, very choice.
Yeah, I would agree with you. As a matter of fact, I also have to give credit here, of course, to Bill Sheehan, who, you know, oversees Subterranean Press and who wanted this book and who told us two of the pieces that absolutely had to be in it as far as he was concerned. And I won't say which ones those are, but they are in the book. Well, I will say what one of them is. It was Apartheid Superstrings and Mordecai,
yes,
Thubana, perhaps the longest story in the book.
I remember that well from when it, yeah, came out.
But he wanted that story and one other in particular, and that was not hard to work around at all. I like that story as well. But Bill was extremely forthcoming and helpful in allowing us to do this book. And I'm sure it would not exist if it had not been for Bill's willingness to undertake it as a project.
Now, you know, it sounds amazing to say, but believe it or not, when we include the outro music for the show, we've got like 20 minutes left. And we were talking about you're reading a story. Another possibility would be to take calls, or we could just keep chatting. I will leave it up to you.
Well, Miriam is the story we were talking about doing. It's the shortest story in the book, and it's one of my favorites. I would be glad to read it if you like. If not, we can talk whatever you like.
I would love it if you read it. I will tell people, by the way, this is an unusual thing. I mean, this program, from when Margot Adler started in 1972 and I took it over in 74, in all these years, I haven't done many phone interviews, and this is the very first time I have ever permitted anybody to read their fiction over the phone.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity.
And I'm pleased we have a good phone line.
Pardon?
I'm pleased we have a good enough phone line.
Yeah, I am too. I was a little bit concerned about that. Well, let me introduce the story and simply say that it's another look at the Christian story, but from a perspective that I think most people would find a little different. Because it's called Miriam, and Miriam in this case is Mary, Jesus' mother. But the story takes a completely different turn as a consequence of something that happens very early on. It's probably less than 2,000 words. And with your permission, I'll go ahead and read it.
You certainly have it.
Miriam. On the night of the blessed infant's coming, things got complicated. Miriam felt her fetus lodged athwart her birth canal, prelude to a disaster of which the archangel had given no warning. "Don't be afraid," he had told her, "for you've found favor with God." She had no certainty of that favor now. "The baby comes crosswise," Joseph cried. Despite the awkwardness of his hands, he turned it slightly and so brought it forth. Yeshua, or the Lord will save, came forth dead, mocking the name that Gabriel had told her to bestow upon it. Now Herod would have no call to massacre all the male babies in this donkey run of a village. Joseph placed the blue child on a stone beside the straw on which Miriam still lay twisted. He beheld it with both resentment and wonder, then put a hand to his chest and opened his mouth like a suffocating fish. His eyes bulged, and he toppled to the cavern's hard, uneven floor. "Joseph," Miriam cried, and, "Yeshua, my Yeshua." A bald villager named Gideon took pity on her and saw to both the old man's burial and that of the stillborn Son of God. He sold the spavined animal that had carried her to this place and found her a small room in the crowded caravansary. Too late, thought Miriam. Too late. Gideon fed her figs and bread, and in 3 days she tried to join some Galileans who had heeded the Quirinian census on the road back to Nazareth. Men looked askance. Women muttered behind their hands. Because she had no protector, she often overheard the name Jezebel, or the epithet whore. Again, Gideon rescued her. On a tall, whey-colored horse, he returned Miriam to the hill cave in which Joseph and Yeshua had died. What did he want? Her heart misgave her. However, if Gideon hoped to rape or murder her, she would fight. She would tear at him like a wounded dog. But in the cave, he expanded and glowed, without growing larger or brighter, and Miriam recognized him as Gabriel, the angel who had erroneously announced the advent of her lost son and a mysterious, unending kingdom. His voice, when he spoke, twinned or tripled so that he sounded like a small choir. "Rejoice, Miriam, for you among women are most favored and blessed. The Lord stands with you, his might a cloak about your shoulders." "No," said Miriam, "tell him to get somebody else." Gideon, or rather Gabriel, dimmed a little. "Hear me, child, I bring good tidings from the highest." "No, I gave my all. It didn't work. Why would God wish me to suffer 9 more months of foolish hope and another fruitless labor?" "Miriam, hush and obey. God or demon, he has no right. If he wants his son to wear the suffering flesh of a mortal, let some other suffering mortal do his work. A woman whose womb will free, not strangle, his beloved get." "You misapprehend the Lord God's new design." "Why did his first design go awry? Did I anger him somehow?" "No, no, Satan pranked your womb. Now the highest must answer." "By making me his cow again? Why didn't he just undo that heartbreaking prank and let his little son live?" Gabriel raised his arms, which now bore snow-white and blue-black plumage, and threw her into shadow. "Enough. The Lord God wishes to anoint and transfigure you, Miriam. He no longer wishes you to bear his son, but to step forth from his cave, his only inspirited daughter, the Messiah of this age and all the following." Miriam's breath stopped, but eventually began again. And the brief career of Miriam Messiah had no parallel. Biding her young womanhood in Nazareth, apprenticing as a weaver, she made garments of such perfection that teachers and magistrates alike clamored for them. She traded for lessons with the rabbis and for dispensations from public officials for needy neighbors, but showed no more preference for the rich than for shepherds or tax collectors. At length, having increased in learning, wisdom, and stature, she left her master weaver to proclaim throughout Galilee and Judea the kingdom of heaven. From as many trades, denominations, and peoples as would hear, she called disciples, both women and men, always with a suspicion that she was not only shadowing her stillborn son, but also extending his lost ministry. She provoked resentment among the hidebound and hostility among the powerful by disputing with the learned outside synagogues, and once in a court welcoming to women near the temple. She made bad wine sweet, broken bodies whole, and a host of frenzied minds serene. Hecklers, Jew, Roman, Samaritan, she disarmed with sage and gentle words. Homilies and epigrams she dispensed with the skill of a venerable apothecary. Demons she cast out with the ferocity of a God-fueled warrior. Healings she administered freely to almost anyone. The arrogant, avaricious, and cruel she rebuked with authority, but also with tenderness. The pious, smug, and hypocritical she shoved to the walls of their self-delusions and held them there with questions that stripped them naked of the virtues they thought their dress by birthright or seizure. And so, of course, they accused her of slander, blasphemy, and unnatural acts with her bemused disciples. "I am daughter of wisdom," she said, "queen of nations, mother of faith, sister of spirit and peace. Whosoever would know the Most High's heart need but wrap herself in a robe of my weaving and live within it as if within her own skin. We are fearfully and intricately shaped in Sophia's womb and issue from it primed to glorify both her and her all-embracing partner, El Shaddai." These sayings and others like them enraged Pharisees, Levites, and instructors of the law. Meanwhile, talk of herself as Israel's consolation and of an enigmatic coming kingdom unsettled the Roman colonizers, and an advisor to the emperor himself warned the procurator of Judea to help the Jews suppress this untoward female abomination and threat. Then Dorcas betrayed her, and Miriam was arrested, tried, convicted, scourged, and harried along the Via Dolorosa to a fate that flickered in her awareness like that of a son she had never fully known. Dorcas fled with her silver, but the Jewish and Roman leaders agreed that this heretical Miramist movement demanded a vivid joint response. During its namesake's trial, they arrested and sentenced to death a host of her disciples, even picking out 11 women to die with Miriam on Golgotha, the Mount of Skulls. This seemed just, given the woman's defiance of traditional proprieties and religious strictures and their unswerving loyalty to Miriam. No mild insurrection, it wanted a strong rebuttal, and neither the procurator nor the high priest had any qualms about crucifying 11 women with her. After all, the Romans made few gender distinctions when punishing slaves or foreigners, and once at Ashkelon, a ruler named Simeon ben Shetah had ordered over 70 sorceresses nailed up for their presumption and apostasy. And so Miriam staggered out of the city behind the black Cyrenian carrying her cross. Much of her hair had been snatched away, and blood had dried on her innumerable stripes like holly berry husks. She looked up. On the small dome of Golgotha, a forest of crosses thrust up in two tight rings about its apex. From each cross hung a woman who had accompanied Miriam during the nearly 3 years of her God-sparked evangelical campaign, but she could not easily identify them because the soldiers, at the behest of the Hebrew priests, had affixed them to their crosses face first out of some warped notion of executionary decency. Still, Miriam knew their names: Abigail, Bilhah, Chloe, the twins Dinah and Rachel, Esther the matriarch, Merab, Naomi, Shunammite, Zilpah, and Esther the maid, all dying for her, all dying for the sisterhood of heaven. The soldiers nailed Miriam to her cross facing front and naked but for a blood-streaked loincloth. They erected her stake at the top of Skull Mount, the highest tree in a glade of such impalings, and they diced not for her garments, a woman's contemptible things, but for the right to break her legs when the time came and to expose her totally once she had died. Meanwhile, a society of Jewish women, none of them Miriam's followers, prowled the uneven slopes offering drugged wine to the sufferers, but Miriam refused this kindness, and her crucified disciples were not physically positioned to receive it. So at length, alternately laughing and cursing, the soldiers chased these sad do-gooders down the hill and back into the city. "Father, mother," rasped Miriam lowly, "why have you forsaken us?" But one was resurrected, and Dorcas, in lifelong atonement for her betrayal, traveled and preached and healed and wrote, so that, several generations on, Miriamism overcame the entire world, and much in the world that was stupid, arbitrary, and cruel, inevitably, albeit gradually, lost its foothold.
And you've been listening to Michael Bishop reading his short story, Miriam, republished in The Door Gunner and Other Perilous Flights of Fancy, edited by Michael H. Hutchins, and in hardcovers from Subterranean Press. That is wonderful.
Thank you.
And it certainly, we were talking earlier, and it really, it's so interesting. You know, we have like 10 minutes left, and I wish that we had 10 hours left, because that alone brings up questions. But the first name that it brings to my mind, of course, is James Morrow.
Mm-hmm.
And his bizarre comic novel, Only Begotten Daughter. You are a churchgoer, are you not?
I am.
I mean, at least you cook for one, but...
Oh, well, I don't cook. I clean up. I wish I were a cook. Tonight I was there, as a matter of fact, cleaning up afterwards along with my wife, Jerry, and we've done this for 15 years at least. We go to eat at Wednesday night supper, and then we spend our time cleaning tables, washing pots and pans. In fact, they call me the Big Pan Man.
So my question is, how is a story like that received in your church group?
Well, I'm afraid that some people look at it and think that it's blasphemous, but my entire idea here is that what would have happened if for some unforeseeable reason the Savior that God had appointed had died? What would he have done?
Yeah.
And could it have been a woman? Could it have been Mary, Jesus' mother? And my feeling is, well, it could have been. The society was much different in those days, of course, and women were looked down upon in the sense that they did not have the rights and privileges that men had. But they were also respected in their own sphere of things. And sometimes they could obtain a degree of position and authority. And here you can see that it's happening in a completely different way than we have experienced the presence of the Son of God among us. And to me, it's a religious story, but I can recognize that some people would look at it as being a violation of what they see as the true story.
Well, it's certainly not fundamentalist.
No, it's definitely not fundamentalist. And
I think that anything that is not fundamentalist threatens fundamentalists.
It does. It does. And, of course, you know, I have found people who are humorless about religion, and because they are so committed to what it is that they believe, that they don't think that one can talk about it facetiously and still retain any degree of real faith. I'm not one of those people.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, there's a little bit of head-butting, and sometimes there may be misunderstanding, but
and
I don't know what else to say.
I perhaps have the luxury of, I wouldn't say being a complete outsider looking in, because after all, it's Judeo-Christianity.
Sure.
Not just Christianity, but the... You know, I see the reverence in the story. I see the and I find that in Morrow for all of his, you know, my God, heretical writings.
Oh yes, and Jim, you know, says that he is an atheist. I'm not an atheist, but I can certainly understand where he comes from in the sense that I believe that he takes these questions seriously in the way that some believers do not.
You know, yeah.
Some believers do not think as seriously and as profoundly about these issues as Jim does.
I think he's got actually quite a bit of faith, even if it is in atheism.
Right.
It's something that he has considered, and he certainly grasps and understands the word of which he writes. Last week, I broadcast an interview I did during the Nebula Awards weekend with Connie Willis, who I've interviewed like five times, and it's you can never go wrong with Connie Willis. She's
right.
Such a delight, and I've been rereading her of late, especially her Oxford Time Travel series. And there, you know, and here is another one who is on the one hand not reverent precisely to the word, but my, is she
true to the spirit.
Perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely true to the spirit. You know, the feeling of religion really comes through and is, you know, from my point of view, so admirable for what she is writing, because she's writing of, and this is what my father taught me, ethics and morality.
Mm-hmm.
And from the story that you just read, what I am getting from that is sort of the truth will out.
Right, and I'm thinking here too, you know, that it is true to my own faith in the sense that I don't reject the idea of a Messiah or a Savior. I'm just wondering, you know, what would have happened had that Savior or Messiah been female?
So it's speculative fiction.
Right, it is. It's speculative fiction, and I don't intend it to offend anybody, but I'm sure that it probably has and probably will, but I certainly don't intend to make mock of anyone's faith.
Yeah, but you can't be a thinker today and not step on toes now, can you?
I'm afraid it's almost impossible. If you are thinking about things in a sideways manner how can you be orthodox if you're thinking crooked?
Yeah, that's a wonderful way of putting it.
Yeah.
Well, to me, it is a sad, sad thing to say that we have literally 2 minutes before I have to go off the air. And I see Lister is not here tonight. Ahmad is here, yes? He shrugs. You're supposed to say yes, and I'm Ahmad Ali is here, and you're calling the show. Still Burn Baby Burn Clappers, but with Ahmad Ali?
Cafe Ali visiting.
Okay, very good. Very good. Cafe Ali visiting. A little taste of WUSB on WBAI. But, Michael.
Yes.
I'm going to take the 90 seconds I've got left to gush and say what an honor it is to have finally, after 40 years of doing this show, having finally gotten you on the air.
Well, I'm sorry that we haven't done it before. I rarely get up to New York. I love to come there, but it's been a long time since I have been there. And
yeah.
I would like nothing better than to visit the city and to sit down with you face to face. But this is the way it worked out, and I'm glad that we were able to do it. And I thank you so much for allowing me to come on your program.
Well, and vice versa. The pleasure is all ours. And, you know, next time I would like to be able to take phone calls, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing is that it's also my fault, because I have been there have been times that I've walked down the long road at ReaderCon, and I've seen somebody walking by with a badge saying Michael Bishop. But I'd be, you know, in conversation with somebody else, but I always have my tape recorder on me.
Mm-hmm.
And the next time I see you at a convention, The next one I'm going to is World Fantasy. I don't get to that many, but ReaderCon is a regular of mine.
Right.
And I know that you go there.
I like ReaderCon very much, and I've probably been there as many times as I've been to any convention, which is twice.
and as guest of honor.
Yes.
Yeah, so, but the next time we find that we are attending a common convention, Nebula Award, presentation, whatever.
We'll have to have dinner and sit down and talk.
Yes, absolutely. I so look forward to that.
Well, I hope that that can happen soon.
Likewise. And it has, again, thank you for being here. It has been such an honor and pleasure. We have to remind people, two new books, or rather two books of your that are republished, and one is Brittle Innings, which you can't just describe as speculative fiction or just as a baseball novel. It's, it comes close to being a great, if not the great, American novel.
Well, I wouldn't say it's the great American novel, but just to have somebody say that, mention it, is an honor.
And it certainly does that. And then The Door Gunner and Other Perilous Flights of Fancy is just, you know, the perfect primer filled with great short stories.
Thank you.
So, again, thank you, Mike, for being here.
Again, it was my pleasure, and I'm going to see if I can go back to sleep.
Okay, please do that, and have a good morning. And you and I will talk, or at least write each other in the next couple of days.
Right, and I've got a book for you here, The Conduct of the Game by John Huff.
All about umpires.
I don't know how to pronounce his last name, and I'm going to be sending it to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Uh-huh.
Have a great morning.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And everybody, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back next week from 1:30 to 3 a.m. I don't know with what, but it'll be good. And the following Thursday, I'm going to be doing an interview with some guy named Cory Doctorow and another guy named Charles Strauss. Gushing, I am. It's been a great month. And Friday, you know what's important about Friday, right? Well, let the tune that I'm playing tell you. Let Billie Holiday tell you. Friday is the blue moon. And listen to Ella sing it. Listen to Billie Holiday sing it. And just enjoy yourselves. And stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn with Ahmad Ali. Good morning.
Saw me standing alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. New moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me saying a prayer for someone I really could care for. And then they suddenly appeared before me, the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone. Without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.
I am a proletarian. I am a proletarian.
The red part of the balloon spit on you.
piece of cloth. That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk. Cross the system, work to jerk. My people's the people all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my writing is writing the Constitution. Yo, that shit's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too.
WBAI New York.
Need a bit of loving, not the one that I had to raise my hands to the Father. I said thank you, God. Hills and valley, no road we have to track. No one book up in the love that would never make me sad. Jump up in the air that made me feel extra glad.
Thank you.
wake up in the night. I couldn't find my feeling. No. Early in the morning. Oh, mercy. It's just the same situation. Taking the landlord. Yeah. Just a knocking knock on my door. Knocking up on my door. I've got 400 miles rent to pay, and I can't find a dollar.
from Zion, Rastaman Allah.